From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Kit McGar by B.M. Croker. Whence and what art thou, execrable shape? Milton. Perhaps you have seen them more than once on railway platforms in the Northwest provinces. A shabby, squalid, weary-looking group, sitting on their battered baggage or scrambling in and out of intermediate compartments. I mean Jackson, the photographer and his belongings. Jackson is not his real name, but it answers the purpose. These are people who will tell you that Jackson is a man of good family, that he once held a commission in a crack cavalry regiment, and that his brother is Lord Lieutenant of his county, and his nieces are seen at court balls. Then how comes their kinsman to have fallen to such low estate, if kinsman he be? This seedy-looking, unshorn reprobate, with a collarless flannel shirt, greasy deerstalker, and broken tennis shoes. If you look into his face, her ones may read the answer. Jackson drinks, or his swollen features and inflamed nose and watery and uncertain eye greatly belie him. Jackson was a mauvais sujet from his youth upwards, if the truth must be confessed. At school he was always in trouble and in debt. At Oxford his scrapes were so prominent that he had more than one narrow escape of being sent down. Who would believe to look at him now that he had once been a very pretty boy, the youngest and best-looking of a handsome family, and naturally his mother's darling? Poor woman. While she lived, she shielded him from duns and dons, and from his father's wrath. She pawned her diamonds and handed over her pin money to pay his bills. She gave him advice, and he gave her kisses. By the time he had joined his regiment, this reckless youth had lost his best friend, but his bad luck, as he termed it, still clung to him and overwhelmed him. His father had a serious interview with his colonel, paid up like a liberal parent, and agreed to his son's exchange into a corps in India. India may steady him, thought his sanguine old gentleman, but alas, it had anything but the desired effect. In India, the prodigal became more imprudent than ever. Cards, racing, Simkin soon swallowed up his moderate allowance, and he fell headlong into the hands of the Sukars, a truly fatal fall. 20% per month makes horrible ravages in the income of a subaltern, and soon he was hopelessly entangled in debt, and had acquired a disagreeable reputation of being a man who never paid for anything, and always let others in when it was a question of rupees. Then his name was whispered in connection with some very shady racing transaction, and finally he was obliged to leave the service, bankrupt alike in honor and credit. His father was dead. His brothers unanimously disowned him, and for 20 years he fell from one grade to another, as he roamed over India from Peshawar to Madras and Rangoon to Bombay. He had been in turn planter, then planter's clerk, house agent, Tonga agent. He had tried touting for a tailoring firm and manufacturing hill jams. And here he was at 50 years of age, with a half-caste wife, a couple of dusky children, and scarcely an anna in his pocket. Undoubtedly, he had put the coping stone on his misfortunes when he took for his bride the pretty, slatternly daughter of a piano tuner, a girl without education, without energy, and without a penny. 10 years ago, Fernanda Braganza had been a charming creature, with the fleeting beauty of her kind, a sylphan form with superb dark eyes, fairy-like feet, and a pronounced taste for pink ribbons, patchouli, and pearl powder. This vision of beauty who had gushed to Jackson with her soul in her exquisite eyes, and who was not insensible to the honor of marrying a gentleman Was she the self-same individual as this great fat woman in carpet slippers and a bulging tweed ulster, who stood with a sallow, hungry-looking child in either hand? Alas, she was. The Jacksons had come to try their fortunes at Panipur, a small up-country station where there were two European regiments and half a battery of artillery. For is not Tommy Atkins ever a generous patron to an inexpensive photographer? The finances of the family were at a very low ebb that February afternoon, as they stood on the platform collecting their belongings, a camera and chemicals, a roll of frowsy bedding, a few cooking things, a couple of boxes, also a couple of grimy servants. In India, the poorest have a following, and third-class tickets are cheap. Jackson had a three-finger peg at the bar, although there was but little in his pocket. Besides, a few cards and paper posters, and thus invigorated, proceeded to take steps respecting the removal of his family. Poverty forbade their transit in a couple of tikka garis, and pride shrank from an ekka. Therefore, Jackson left his wife in the waiting room whilst he tramped away in the blinding sun and powdery white dust to see if there was accommodation at the dock bungalow. It proved to be crammed, and he had not yet come down to the serai, or native halting place. He was, when sober, a man of some resource. He made his way up to the barracks and asked questions, and heard that the station was in the same condition as the dock bungalow, quite full. Even Fever Hall and Cholera Villa were occupied, and the only shelter he could put his head into was the big two-storied bungalow in the Pyween Road. It had been empty for years. It was said to be had at a nominal rent, say 2 rupees a week, and there was no fear of anyone disturbing him there. It was large and close to the barracks, but greatly out of repair. With this useful intelligence, Mr. Jackson rejoined his impatient circle, and with their goods in a handcart, they started off for this house of refuge without delay. Past the native bazaar, past the officers' mess, past the church, then along a straight, wide road where the crisp, dead leaves crackled underfoot, a road lined with dusty, half-bare trees, whose branches stood out in strong relief against a hard blue sky, whilst a vast tract of grain country, covered with green barley and ripe sugar cane, stretched away on the right. On the left were a pair of great, gaunt gate piers, leading by a grass-grown approach to the two-storied bungalow, an imposing-looking house that was situated well back from the highway, amid a wilderness of trees and rank and rotting vegetation. Distance in this case certainly had lent enchantment to the view. When the little party arrived under the wide, dilapidated portico, they found all the doors closed, the lower windows stuffed with boards, matting, and even paper in default of glass. Weeds and creepers abounded, and there was a dangerous fissure in the front wall. After knocking and calling for about 10 minutes, an ancient chowdhukar appeared, looking half asleep. At first he thought it was merely a party from the station, wishing, as was their eccentric custom, to go over the haunted house, the Bhutia bungalow. But he soon learned his mistake from the voluble, shrill-tongued sahib. This family of shabby Europeans, who had arrived on foot with all their belongings in a tailor from the station, had actually come to stay, to sleep, to live on the premises. Grumbling to himself, he conducted them up an exceedingly rickety, not to say dangerous, staircase, for the lower rooms were dark and damp, to 3 or 4 large and cheerful apartments opening on a fine veranda. Mrs. Jackson was accustomed to pitching her tent in queer places, and in a very short time she had procured from the bazaar a table, a few chairs, and a couple of charpoys, and furnished 2 rooms. She had but little to unpack, whilst Kadir Bucks, the family slave, vibrated between cooking and chemicals. Meanwhile, Mr. Jackson, having washed, shaved, and invested himself in his one linen collar and black alpaca coat, set forth on a tour of inspection to stick up posters and distribute cards. His wife also made her rounds. The upper rooms were habitable, and the veranda commanded a fine view. It overlooked the park-like but neglected compound, intersected with short cut paths, in which, despite its 2 grand entrance gates, was now without hedge or paling and quite open to the road, a road down which not a few ladies and gentlemen in bamboo carts or in ponies were trotting past for their evening airing. Below the suite Mr. Jackson had chosen were the dismal, vault-like rooms, the chowkidar with his charpoyan hooks, and beyond, at the back of the bungalow, the servants' quarters and stables, both roofless. Behind these ruins stretched an immense overgrown garden, with ancient dried-up fruit trees, faint traces of walks and water channels, and a broken fountain and sundial, now abandoned to cattle. On the whole, Mrs. Jackson was pleased with the survey. She had never inhabited such a lordly-looking mansion, and felt more contented than she had done for a long time, especially as Jackson was on his best behavior. He had no friends in the place, and scarcely any funds. In a short time, Mr. Jackson had acquired both. His good address, his gentlemanly voice, and the whisper of his having once been an officer who had come to grief, who had been unfortunate, went far in a military station. With extraordinary discretion, he kept his belongings entirely out of sight. He also kept sober, and consequently received a number of orders for photographs of groups, of bungalows, and of polo ponies. He had the eye of an artist, and really knew his business, and although somewhere startled at the strength of the pegs which he accepted, he had a large and lucrative connection in less than no time, and rupees came flowing in fast. As he and the invaluable Kadir worked together, he talked glibly to portly field officers and smooth-faced subalterns, of men whom he had known, men whose names at least were familiar to them, distinguished veterans, smart soldiers, and even celebrated personages. He attended church and sang lustily out of a little old prayer book and looked such a picture of devout, decayed gentility that the tender-hearted ladies pitied him and thought him quite romantic, and hastened to order photographs of all their children, or children being lacking dogs. Little did they know that Mr. Jackson's shabby prayer book would have been sold for drink years previously, only that he found it an absolute unmarketable article. Meanwhile, Mrs. Jackson was convinced that she was positively about to be a lady at last. She purchased frocks for her sallow girls, a dress and boots for herself. She set up a rocking chair and a cook and occasionally drove to the bazaar in a tikka gari, where she looked down with splendid dignity on the busy bargaining wives of Tommy Atkins. The chaplain's lady had called upon her, also the barrack sergeant's wife, who lived in a small bungalow on quarters beyond the garden. She had haughtily snubbed this good woman at first, but subsequently had thawed toward her for several reasons. Jackson, having been uproariously drunk and unpleasantly familiar to an officer, had now fallen back on the sergeant's mess for his society, and on private soldiers for his patrons. He was still doing a roaring trade, especially in carte de visite, at 6 rupees a dozen. He bragged and talked and even wept to his listeners in the barrack rooms, and in the canteen, listeners who thought him as uncommonly fine fellow, liberal as a lord, flinging his coin right and left. They little guessed the usual sequel, or of how the Jackson family were wont to steal out of a station by rail in the gray dawn of an Indian morning, leaving many poor natives who had supplied their wants in the shape of bread and meat, coffee, and even clothes, to bewail their too abrupt departure. Jackson was on the drink, as his wife frankly expressed it, never home before 12 o'clock at night, and then had to be helped upstairs, and Mrs. Jackson found these evenings extremely wearisome. She rarely read, but she did a little crochet and not a little scolding. She slept a good deal, and as long as her coffee and her curry were well and punctually served, she was fairly content, for she was naturally lethargic and indolent, but still she liked to talk, and here she had no one with whom to exchange a word. She pined for the sound of another female tongue, and accordingly one afternoon she arrayed herself in her new hat with scarlet cock's feathers, also her yellow silk gloves, and with a cook as a body servant to carry her umbrella, she sallied forth to return the visit of the barrack sergeant's wife. She had not far to go, only through the garden and across the road. The barrack sergeant's wife was knitting outside her veranda, for the weather was warming up, when Mrs. Jackson, all gorgeous in her best garments, loomed upon her vision. Now, Mrs. Clark had no notion of the wives of drunken photographers giving themselves hairs, and don't go far to tell her as ever that Jackson was a gentleman, a fellow that went reeling home from the canteen every night. But she disassembled her feelings and stood up rather stiffly and invited her visitor into her drawing-room, a small apartment, the walls colored gray, furnished with cheap straw chairs, covered in gaudy cretonne, further embellished by billowy white curtains, tottering little tables, and a quantity of photographs in cotton velvet frames, a room of some pretensions, and Mrs. Clark's pride. Its unexpected grandeur was a blow to Mrs. Jackson, as was also the appearance of two cups of tea on a tray, accompanied by a plate of four water biscuits. It seemed to her that Mrs. Clark also set up for being quite the lady, although her husband was not a gentleman. The two matrons talked volubly, as they sipped their tea, of bizarre prices, cheating hawkers, and the enormities of their servants. "My cook" was continually in Mrs. Jackson's mouth. They played a fine game of brag in which Mrs. Jackson, despite her husband, who had been an officer, of her cook, and of her large house, came off second best. "I can't think," she said, looking round contemptuously, "how you can bear to live in these stuffy quarters. I'm sure I couldn't. It would kill me in a week. You should see the splendid rooms we have. They do say it was once a palace and built by a nabob." "Maybe so," coolly rejoined her hostess. "I know it was a mess house, and after that an officer's chummery, 15 or 20 years ago. But no one would live there now unless they had no other roof to cover them, and came to a place like a parcel of beggars." "Why? What's up with it?" inquired Mrs. Jackson, suddenly becoming of a dusky puss, even though her pearl powder. "Don't you know? And you there this 2 months and more?" "Indeed, I don't. What is there to know?" "And haven't you seen him?" demanded Mrs. Clark, in a key of intense surprise. "I mean the Khitmatgar." "I declare I don't know what you are talking about," cried the other peevishly. "What Khitmatgar?" "What Khitmatgar? Hark at her! Why, a short, square-shouldered man in a smart blue coat, with a regimental badge in his turban. He has very sticking-out, curling black whiskers, and a pair of wicked eyes that look as if they could stab you, though he salaams to the ground whenever you meet him." "I believe I have seen him. Now you mentioned it," rejoined Mrs. Jackson. "Rather a tidy-looking servant with, as you say, a bad expression. But bless you, we have such crowds of officers' messengers coming with chits to my husband, I never know who they are. I've seen him now and then of an evening, I'm sure, though I don't know what brought him or whose servant he is." "Servant?" echoed the other. "Why, he is a ghost. The ghost that haunts the bungalow." "Ah, now, Mrs. Clark," said her visitor patronizingly, "you don't tell me you believe such rubbish." "Rubbish?" indignantly. "Is it? Oh, just you wait and see. Ask old Mr. Soames, the pensioner, as has been here this 30 year. Ask anyone, and they will tell you the same story." "Story indeed," cried Mrs. Jackson, with a loud, rude laugh. "Well, it's a true story, ma'am, but you need not hear it unless you like it." "Oh, but I should like to hear it very much," her naturally robust curiosity coming to the front. "Please do tell it to me." "Well, 20 years ago, more or less, some young officers lived in that bungalow, and one of them, in a passion, killed his Khitmatgar. They say he never meant to do it, but the fellow was awfully cheeky, and he threw a bottle at his head and stretched him dead. It was all hushed up, but that young officer came to a bad end, and the house began to get a bad name. People died there so often. Two officers of delirium tremens. One cut his throat. Another fell over the veranda and broke his neck. And so it stands empty. No one stays a week." "And why?" demanded the other boldly. "Lots of people die in houses. They must die somewhere." but not as they do there," Shirley interrupted Mrs. Clark. "The khitmatgar comes around at dusk or at night, just like an ordinary servant, with pegs or lemonade and so on. Whoever takes anything from his hand seems to get a sort of madness on them, and goes and destroys themselves." "It's a fine tale, and you tell it very well," said Mrs. Jackson, rising and nodding her red cock's feather and her placid, dark, fat face. "There does be such in every station. People must talk, and they won't frighten me." And having issued this manifesto, she gave her hostess a limp shake of the hand and waddled off. "She's jealous of the grand big house and fine compound fit for gentry," said Mrs. Jackson to herself, "and she thinks to get me out of it. Not that she could get in, for she has to live in quarters, and she is just a dog in the manger. And anyways, it's a made-up story from first to last." As she reached her boat and called, "Kui hai, Butilao," a figure came out from the passage, salaamed respectfully, and by the light of a two-anna lamp on the staircase, she descried the strange khitmatgar, whose appearance was perfectly familiar to her. A short, square, surly-looking person. No doubt he was one of Kadir's many friends. The lower rooms were generally overrun with his visitors. "Send Kadir," she said imperiously, and went upstairs. And as she spoke, the man salaamed again and vanished. The wife of his bosom had a fine tale to tell Mr. Jackson the next morning, as with a very shaky hand he was touching up some plates in his own room. "A khitmatgar that offers free pegs," he exclaimed with a shout of laughter. "Too good to be true. Why, I'd take a whiskey and soda from the devil himself, and glad to get it. My mouth is like a lime kiln at this moment." "Ki hai, whiskey pani do." Many days, warm and sweltering days, rolled on. The hot winds blew the crackling leaves before them, blew great clouds of red dust along the roads, blew ladies up to the hills, and dispersed many of Jackson's patrons. But he did not care. He had made a good many rupees. He had more than one boon companion, and he drank harder than ever. Why not, he demanded. He had earned the money, and he had the best right to spend it. He was earning none now. When customers came, Kadir always informed them the sahib was sota, asleep. Yes, sleeping off the effects of the preceding night. Mrs. Jackson was accustomed to the state of affairs, and what she called his attacks. She rocked herself, fanned herself, and dozed, and did a little crochet, while the two children played quietly in a back room with old photographs and bits of cardboard. When her husband did wake and enjoy a few hours' lucid interval, it was only to recall bills and duns and flashes of his old life, the cool green park at home, the hunting field, reviews at Aldershot, his pretty cousin Ethel. Then the chill reality forced itself upon his half-crazy brain. The park was his great barren scorched compound, with the hot winds roaring across it. The figure in the veranda was not Ethel in her riding habit, but Fernanda in carpet slippers and a greasy old dressing gown. Was this life worth living? Mrs. Jackson had seen the khitmatgar several times. Once she noticed him looking down at her as she ascended the stairs. Once he had appeared in answer to her call, carrying a tray, glasses. But she had boldly waved him away and said, "Send Kadir. Why does he allow strangers to do his work?" There was something far too human about the appearance of the man for her to give a moment's credence to the ghost story. One still hot night, a night as bright as day, Mrs. Jackson found the air so oppressive that she could not sleep. She lay tossing from side to side on her charpoy, looking out on the moon-flooded veranda and listening to the indefatigable brain-fever bird, when suddenly she heard her husband's familiar call. "Ki hai, Peg Lau." He had been drinking as usual and had fallen into a sodden sleep in his own room. After an unusually short interval, steps came up the stairs. Shoes were audibly slipped off, and there were sounds of the jingling of a glass and bottle. The door of Mrs. Jackson's apartment opened into the veranda and stood wide, on account of the intense breathless heat of that Indian night. In a few moments, someone came and paused on the threshold, tray in hand, someone who surveyed her with a grin of satanic satisfaction. It was the strange Kit McGar. There was a triumphant expression in his eyes that made her blood run cold. And while she gazed, transfixed with horror, he salaamed and was gone. In a second, she had jumped out of bed. She ran into the veranda. Yes, the long veranda was empty. He had disappeared. She called excitedly to her husband. No answer. She rushed into his room to unfold her experience. Jackson was sitting at the table, or rather half lying across it, his hands clenched, his features convulsed, his eyes fixed, quite dead. He had swallowed one of his chemicals, a fatal poison. Of course, there was the usual ephemeral excitement occasioned by a tragedy in the station, the usual inquest and verdict of temporary insanity, and then a new nameless grave in the corner of the cantonment cemetery. Jackson's fate was generally attributed to whiskey or filthy country liquor. Poor fellow, his position preyed on his mind and he drank himself to death. This was the universal opinion in messroom, barrack room, and bazaar. But there were one or two people, including his wife and Mrs. Clark, who thought otherwise, and who gravely shook their heads and whispered, "The Kit McGar."